you know, as far as the fear that our wild birds getting reinfected with this B313 and passing it to, you know, commercial poultry or to dairy herds, it sounds like the likelihood is pretty slim because they're not actually carrying this genotype of virus in the wild bird population.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
AccuGut C.1 is a proven solution for your coccidiosis toolbox. Give those traditional tools a break and rotate to AccuGut C.1. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/AccuGut to learn more.
AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost poultry health and performance. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. Sid Lines, an Ecolab company, AV Prime program offers a broad range of cleaning and disinfection solutions combined with tailored advice to improve hygiene on your farm or hatchery.
Welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show. Today I'm here again with Dr. Yuko Sato. Welcome back.
Thanks, Liz.
I'm really excited to chat with you about some updates in the avian influenza realm. So I kind of want to hear, I know recently you went to AAAP, poultry land already has all of these ideas about avian influenza, but what are, you know, what are the big updates? What are the big things that you heard just recently?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I've got a couple, so I'll start with some of the big ones. So there's some ongoing studies that are going on because there's a lot of questions that we don't understand about this virus. Something that's probably more related to my field of work because we've done some wild bird surveillance work. So the dairy H5 has started to be kind of on the surface in March. And so they APHIS has done some wild bird surveillance between April and June of 24. And they sampled over 5,000 birds, like wild birds around the area. And so the genotype of this like dairy H5-2344B is called B313. So I'll kind of reference that as we talk about this. They, out of all of the samples, they found no B313 positive samples from these wild birds. And even for any influenza positive, low path, high path, anything influenza, less than 1% was H5N1 from all of the birds that they sampled. So what do we know from this is that, you know, as far as the fear that our wild birds getting reinfected with this B313 and passing it to, you know, commercial poultry or to dairy herds, it sounds like the likelihood is pretty slim, because they're not actually carrying this genotype of virus in the wild bird population.
Yeah. And do they sample live birds, or is it, you know, like hunters come and they send a bird in after, you know, they harvest?
So it's both. So they do hunter harvest and they do some live capturing as well. So both of them are done. Some of the other interesting stuff, there's more, you know, there recently over that time, like aside from dairy cattle, there's been other mammalian detections of this virus. And so the two that kind of made the press, one was back in around spring break, we had a Minnesota goat herd that was testing positive, and they had some goats that had some neurologic signs, or the kids that came out of pregnant goats that had neurologic signs, and they actually ended up all dying. And this was related to a flock of birds that were depopulated, but they did not find the B313 in this goat herd. But what they did find was a genotype 3.6, which is related to B313. The interesting catch is these goats that aborted or not aborted had some stillbirths, and some neurologic goats also had Q fever. So they had some comorbidities going on with this herd.
Yeah.
The more interesting one is in May in Idaho, there was a herd of alpacas that actually tested positive. But this one did have B313 genotype, but they didn't have any comorbidities. And there were other backyard birds, I think there were chickens and ducks on this on this premise, and they did get sick and they were depopulated from this event too. So that's kind of the interesting stuff that's going on with this virus that we're trying to understand at this point. Yeah.
Boehringer Ingelheim develops poultry vaccines of unparalleled quality with a focus on prevention and control across a wide range of diseases. We deliver unique, sustainable solutions for broilers, layers, breeders, and turkeys. Our veterinary network brings unsurpassed knowledge and experience, helping producers make smart, innovative, science-driven decisions to improve bird health and performance. For more information, visit PoultryHealthUSA.com.
So with this particular virus that seems to be able to move into other species, how do you think it's getting to the site if the wild birds are not carrying it?
Yeah, so I think the epi study that they did with like the Michigan case study has a lot of information, like kind of rehashing some of that stuff, but In general, the virus isn't shed in very many places aside from the udder. So another interesting fun fact is they're doing some challenge trials to reproduce the signs and, you know, virus replication in the cattle. So what they did was they got this virus and they gave it nasally to the dairy cattle, and they're actually not able to make the virus go to the udder. So what they did was they were able to reproduce it by giving intermammary inoculations. And that's when they were able to get, you know, virus produced in the milk.
Yeah.
And it seems like once it's there, it has a pretty high affinity there, and they'll shed virus pretty significantly there. And I think from all of the epi studies, and another fun fact is like, if you have dairies that are robotic, it seems like the spread between the herd is actually pretty slow. So there is some evidence that says, you know, like robotic dairies, proper sanitation in between, you know, the milkings with the machinery, a lot less people handling it. So I think the transmission is most likely through milk.
Yeah. So I think, do you have data that kind of shows the prevalence of that particular virus from sampled dairy herds? Is it higher than we expect? Or
yes. So I think there was a study that they did. I believe this was like done with like CDC, but they tested 275 bulk tank samples, and 57% of them were positive by PCR. Out of the samples that were positive, 24.8% of them were positive by virus isolation. But fear not, with pasteurization, they did the, you know, high temperature, short time, the 15 seconds at 72 degrees Celsius that completely inactivated the virus. So that's good. Good to know. They've also done, I believe, some meat studies as well too. So they kind of looked at, retail hamburger studies. I believe there was a study where they, got kind of ground beef, and at 120 degrees Fahrenheit, they were actually looking at whether or not you can reduce virus or kill virus. And it looks like 120 is not enough. So if you cook hamburger at like the 165, it'll kill the virus. But, yeah, you know, depending on but there's a lot of caveats to the study, like how thick was the patty, you know, like how evenly distributed it was, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of caveat to that too. So lots of different studies going around, but kind of take all these studies with a grain of salt, look at the specs of the studies done and how it was conducted, and, you know, whether or not it was PCR positive, meaning there's RNA particle present, but no viable virus, versus like a virus isolation positive where there's actual viable virus. So yeah, lots of teasing out data, and, you know, like careful what you read kind of deal. So,
oh my gosh. Yeah. So what's the current state of knowledge on how dairy cattle are getting sick? So it's hard to get this maybe from respiratory route. Like, so how do you think, what do you think they're doing? Is it movement of cattle? Is it something else?
Yeah, it's hard to say, because again, there's very little like prompted testing per se. So the only requirement is if you have a lactating dairy cattle, they're required to test their milk samples prior to movement. And if there is a positive, you know, they don't put any movement restriction either. So they just, you know, they're not, there's no quarantine. There's no, you know, restriction of like other cattle on that herd that's not lactating from moving, et cetera. So who knows who's shedding, who's carrying, who's contaminated from, you know, other things, et cetera. But there is definite evidence that is they're transmitting cattle to cattle. So there's that evidence there as well, too. And again, as I'm learning, too, on like how cattle movement goes. So when in my previous life, when I work with dairy cattle, I didn't really talk about how frequently cattle move. But now I'm learning that, you know, they're moving pretty frequently by the truckload, which is like 20, 30 head at a time. And, you know, who knows what's going on in there, you know, as far as like how, you know, how they're spreading in between that, you know, shipment or movement of cattle, or if it happened before the movement happened or what. But it seems like there's a lot more, I guess, like epi data that needs to be teased out.
So I know that Iowa has some different maybe surveillance than other states. Do you think we're ahead of other states, or is it just because some of the cases affected us first from, you know, dairy and poultry?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like all of the cases since like May for our state has all been related to dairy introductions of H5. And so what our state did, which I'm grateful for, because I think that gives us a lot more information, is once there's a positive poultry HPAI site that's detected, they will actually do a required surveillance of all the dairy herds in that control zone. And so that's how we were able to find dairy herds that are positive with it. You know, whether, you know, it happened before or during or after, who knows what. But we're actually up to, I believe, 13 herds that are positive in the state of Iowa. And I'm not sure very many states are doing that, but maybe that will prompt some states to do that. Just a fun fact, as of July 19th, there's 163 dairy herds that are positive for H5 in 13 different states.
Wow.
I think the top is Colorado with 42 herds. And again, there's been some recent detections of HIPATH and Colorado layers as well, too. So that kind of tracks.
Yeah.
There's also been pullet flocks that are associated with it that are now testing positive as well, too. So I'm sure, you know, that kind of prompts you a little bit more information on, you know, if there's positive shedding in dairy herds, that's another potential biosecurity point to worry about as a commercial poultry industry, which is scary to think, because if you asked me 10 years ago, hey, you know, I have cattle and I have chickens. Do I need to worry about something? My probably initial thought would have said, you know what, maybe salmonella, you know, but like if they asked me like, how about HIPATH? I'd be like, nah, you know, whatever, you know, but look at this world today. It's hard to predict, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's just, it's crazy. It was even crazy to think about. And now that it's actually, there's been other reports in other states that just, it's so interesting. So what do you think, I guess, moving forward, do you think other states are going to start implementing some of these other testing guidelines, or are they just kind of in a wait and see?
That's a great question. So I'm hoping that there's going to be a lot more incentive for the dairy producers to test, because right now, so here's what I think. This is my opinion only, but the poultry producers have a pretty good incentive to test, right? So if they test positive, you know, the consequences, they would have to depopulate. But the thing is, they don't want to spread the virus. B, birds are going to die anyway. So, you know, what's the point of waiting around, right, to see if the virus is HIPATH or not? So early detection is going to be imperative for that. And you get indemnified for the flocks that are being put down, right? So that's like a, you know, like the carrot on the stick is, okay, you're going to get incentivized on this by testing, because otherwise the negatives of not testing is you don't get any money back from, you know, putting down your birds, and you come with a bonus of potentially spreading virus and prolonging this issue, right? The problem with the whole dairy situation is no one's getting incentivized on it. So honestly, the people are testing because they're trying to be good neighbors, or they're curious because their milk looks weird or the cattle aren't acting weird. So they're kind of doing it at the honor system. And what I think needs to happen is, you know, some way on saying like, okay, well, if you test positive and you like do a good job finding it when they're still shedding the virus, you know, we'll compensate you for like the amount of dollars the milk is lost for doing. And, you know, but because the only, you know, the consequence right now is what it's doing is like putting a negative press on them and, you know, for them, like potentially losing an export market for milk, which is not great. Right. So I totally get why the producers are kind of cagey about it, because this is something new. You know, biosecurity is kind of a new concept for them as well, too. I understand. I worked in the dairy side, too, so I get it. And there's so little information about what to do. Like you talked a little bit about how are they getting infected, right? Like if the milk is the only source of infection and it's spreading from cattle, are they splashing milk on each other? Or are they like laying down and licking their boob, or, you know, what are they doing to prompt the spread between each other? But like they're not finding it really in many other places, and they don't have a really good sample type to look for as far as like if they're not milking right now or if they don't have any signs showing where they're like not chewing their cud, or, you know, they're acting weird, you know, like what do you prompt, and how many samples do you take per herd, right? Like how many, you know, samplings do you do for what sample type, and can you even be confident that you're not shedding virus if that test's negative, right? So lots of questions that, I mean, for us as a poultry person, like you're like, it's an oropharyngeal swab. You take 11 birds per flock. You know, it's super simple. We're doing surveillance anyway. You know, there's blood samples, all this stuff. So like a lot of that's pretty easy for us. But for the dairy person, it's like, we're just still trying to understand it. And if we find antibodies, I was like, okay, we got exposed, but are we currently shedding the virus? That's a big question mark. So, you know, what do you do with that? And can these herds get reinfected or not? You know, and how long did they carry the virus? There's all this information that's still missing.
So is the poultry PCR, is that reliable for testing any sample? So are you using the same tests as you do for poultry as you are in dairy, just because you know the isolate?
Yeah, there's a screening PCR that's actually for influenza A that we do for like all mammalian species. So we do that for like swine as well, too, to test for swine influenza. So that's kind of the blanket screening PCR. So if that tests positive, there's a specific one for this clade of virus, which is the 2344B. But there's also the H5 subtyping PCR. So we kind of run those concurrently to see like, okay, do you have flu or not? Like pregnant or not pregnant, yes or no? And then kind of go from there, like, okay, what flavor do you have? Is it the 5? Yeah. No, then it's probably something else. And if it's, you know, H5-2344B, then yeah, this is this current strain of virus. And then the detailed report actually comes from our neighbors down the street at MVSL. They do whole genome sequencing of the virus, depending on the, you know, the CT value of the PCR results. And then they can get a lot more information to classify this to a genotype that's related to the strain.
So do you do that for every positive like H5N1 sample, or is this just a normal screening practice to kind of follow flu?
So we actually are required as a Nalan lab. So if we get any flu detection, whether it's negative for H5 or not, that all goes to MVSL for confirmation anyway. Oh. So, yep. Yeah, irrespective of what it is. Yep.
It's a great data collection method.
Yep. What's interesting about this virus, though, is like, you know, well, one thing we all know about influenza is it keeps on changing, right?
Yeah.
But what we do know about this B313 is it seems to be fairly consistent, meaning there's talking to like someone like Dr. Mia Torchetti at MVSL, she was saying like it's surprising how little this virus has changed.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not mutated, which may be good or bad or indifferent, right? But that's something that they're probably tracking over time to see, like, is this virus going to change over time? Because I think the big fear that everybody's thinking about is like, is this going to be something that's going to be zoonotic to people, and how bad is it? You know, is it going to be like overseas where people are getting sick and dying? You know, like that's probably what people are thinking about. Because like, how do we warn, you know, producers or people who are interacting with potentially infected herds or birds, right, to properly equip themselves with PPE to you know, handle them.
So is this the same strain that was has been circulating like consistently from since last fall, kind of the beginning of the migration?
So the 2344B, that's like cladovirus has been the same, but this is a different genotype of virus. Yeah. So like that's how they've been able to say like, is this related to dairy cattle or not? So if you find that virus in that genotype, then they can say, yes, it's related to dairy. And if it's not, it's not. So it's a pretty clear cut thing. And the other thing that kind of helps us is we're in the summer. It's fairly unusual for the poultry industry to continue to have virus positive during the summer months where the 30,000 foot pole, like overview of viruses in general. So there's like DNA viruses and RNA viruses, right? So DNA is pretty stable. So it's pretty strong. And then there's RNA, which is what influenza is. Similar to COVID, it's pretty wimpy. It's pretty easily inactivated. So in the summer months, you know, viruses usually don't like heat and it's dry. So they usually get inactivated pretty quickly. The other thing is influenza is an enveloped virus, which sounds like it has a layer of protection, but actually what it is quite the opposite. So they have this envelope, and once that envelope is damaged, it actually inactivates the virus. So it's a super unstable RNA, wimpy envelope virus. So in theory, it should be easy to kill the virus, but there's a lot of it. So that's probably what makes it infectious and still, you know, spreads from herd to herd. So again, it's one of those where that should be coming into favor in the summer where it's hot and it's dry and it's like 1,000 degrees outside and the virus is like, I can't stay in this environment. But, you know, again, if it's going from, you know, animal to animal and maintaining this host, like it's a little bit insulated.
So do you think, I can't remember when the last poultry flock was positive, but do you think that it has to do with maybe a host that's maintaining it and then some sort of people or machinery or, you know, other inanimate object movement? Like what's the last, was it within the last couple of weeks there was a poultry flock? I mean, it hasn't been as frequent as it was this spring for positives in poultry.
Yeah. So, I mean, now I think like we used to know like the epi curve of the virus because it like usually goes along with spring and fall migration of wild birds. But with this whole linchpin, it's kind of a little bit messed up right now. The last detection was actually July 19th. It's a flock in Colorado. It's a pullet flock actually related to the layer flock that was positive on the 16th. And there has been, again, quite a bit of number of dairy herds that are testing positive, probably related to this this event that happened as well too. So again, you know, how they spread it, you know, my sense is it's probably from people. It's my guess. And any kind of movement, again, any kind of risky event is like movement of cattle, you know, if you're moving birds, even, you know, like, or just kind of equipment, vehicles, et cetera. So I think it's probably that. There's been some speculation of aerosol as well too, but again, I don't know. I mean, there's, again, is that viable virus spreading or not? If there's a lot of it, I can believe it for sure. But, you know, if that's the only way of spreading, I don't know if that's a little bit too weak of a, you know, like an inoculation dose per se.
But, oh, sure. For timing. Yeah.
Yeah. And how, you know, the cattle herds are getting infected too. Like they probably would need to get it somehow. That's another big question that we don't know. Because now we know from some of the challenge studies that it's not, seems like the inoculation from the, you know, the nasal side isn't going to the udder. So something is happening or some different way of inoculation is prompting them from having, you know, the udder be like the target organ for cattle.
So do you think now because of potential movement to other species that maybe some outlook on getting a vaccine might change? I know part of the issue in the past is we do exports, imports, and it has to do with whether or not a flock is positive and looking like it's positive because it produces antibodies. So has there been any talk again about what we might do for a vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if, I guess like there's two questions, right? One is like is how does the poultry industry feel about vaccinating for this right now? And how does the cattle industry feel about vaccinating right now? And as kind of I alluded to, you know, I don't know if there's any incentive for the cattle industry to vaccinate because it's not killing cattle, right. You know, and it could probably shut down trading partners forever if that happens. So there's some trade implications that come with that. And same thing for the poultry industry, you know, like if they vaccinate for this, that could also cause some trade implications as well, too. But I mean, I think we still need to really understand, like, you know, we don't really understand how much vaccines we need, you know, how soon we need to be deploying that, you know, whether or not the regular 2.3.4.4b vaccine will be protective against this genotype of of the virus or not. But I think the question I have when we use vaccine is like, what is our end goal? Like, how do we get out of it? Right. Cause we don't think we can continue to vaccinate forever. So, you know, how do we get out of a non-vaccinating status at the end of the day is kind of my question. And again, I think a lot of people that are way smarter than me are working on this right now, but I think there needs to be a lot of conversations. So I'm hoping that like this topic spurs a lot of conversation between the dairy people and the poultry people to try to figure out how they can work together. At least it's happening in my state, so I'm happy to see that.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, I mean, especially in Iowa where there's larger operations for both dairy and poultry, is they're not usually on the same site, right? So there's got to be another way to transmit between the location. But when it impacts the site, it's a big impact because there's large number or large volume of animals who could potentially be producing virus. So it becomes a bigger deal when it's not just a backyard flock, you know, of 20 or 30 hens that are someone's, you know, small pet operation, if you will. And then they've also got cattle. So it's just a different scale.
That, and like, honestly, I've had backyard people ask me what to do about it. And that's a damn good question. Cause I'm not sure what to tell them right now either.
Yeah.
Cause you know, like if they go to the state fair, are they worried about stuff? Or like if they have cattle and poultry, should they lock them up? Should they separate them, bar them from, you know, accessing each other? Like, you know, like there's all these questions that people ask. And I was like, that's a good question. I don't know, right? If you're moving stuff around, I mean, you might be at a higher risk where your herd or flock is exposed. Like, and I think both sides are worried, like, oh, I'm going to get the virus from the cattle versus like, I'm going to get the virus from the poultry. And I think that's both legitimate questions, you know, like which side is it coming from, you know, and is that a risk for either side? Like, who knows, right? And I don't think there's been very many backyard detections yet on this genotype of the virus as of nowish, but that may change soon. Cause like, I think that's kind of what we happened in 2015. We had very few backyard detections of the virus, but in this 22 to now virus evolution of H5, there's been over 50% of those detections have been in backyard flocks. So that dynamic may change over time too. Who knows? And my hope is that dynamic never happens and this outbreak is ended, but that's probably being way too optimistic about it.
So the risk right now, just because it's the only way or avenue of measuring, it's in lactating cattle. And that does not mean that a cattle that's not lactating, like that herd does not necessarily have a problem. It's just that the milk is where you are getting a positive, right?
Yeah.
So it's more of an issue if you've got a lactating herd, right? It's different than if it's, let's just say, you know, a growing beef animal, right?
Well, I guess that's a great question that we don't have an answer to because we really haven't tested any.
Yeah. But I mean, as it is right now, it just seems like the lactation is where you're finding positives because you're testing a bulk sample, a milk sample, right?
Yeah, but we are seeing evidence that non-lactating cattle and closed herds are getting infected, at least when we do the blood testing or the antibody testing, they are testing positive. So again, the big question is, it seems like, you know, there's a period of time that they will be positive for the antibody and there's a period of time that they shed the virus. I've heard anything from, maybe shedding 2 weeks prior to clinical signs in cattle where they start shedding virus, and even, you know, positive for even 8 weeks, up to 8 weeks of shedding the virus. So there seems to be a lot of variation, probably depending on how slow the virus is moving in the herd. So I think there's a lot of big question marks on how it's coming in and how long it's staying there. And is it going out, or are they constantly being reinfected or not, or whatever? But there's definitely evidence. And I think the antibody testing is helping. But now that, you know, let's say, you know, this, I would say like first round of infection goes around, how long does the antibody stick around to where, you know, like, is there some protective immunity once the herds are positive, right? Is that like kind of like a free vaccine, right? I call it a, like a, so when I got COVID and I got exposed to COVID again, I think I just recovered from an infection. So I gave myself a free vaccine, right? So does that work as a free vaccine or not? And if, you know, and that back to the vaccination for cattle question, if most of the herds are infected and recovered and however long that, you know, like that booster from the infection lasts, like, do they really want a vaccine or not? That's a separate question. But
so if you're a commercial producer right now, I mean, what's your best advice? Just maintain your biosecurity as normal, pay more attention to cattle movement. I don't know. It just seems hard.
Yeah, I think what some companies have been doing, you know, especially if you have workers that cross between, you know, the different industries, what people have been doing is perhaps looking at, you know, if there's repurposing of personnel, like let's say, for example, you work part-time at a dairy and you also work for a poultry operation, you know, making sure that person doesn't do live animal work on both sides and maybe do more paperwork type stuff or QAQC that's not related to physically going to the sites, you know. So there's ways to kind of mitigate that risk. But, you know, it's hard to say because some of the risk is like, oh, I live in the same, you know, quarters as this other person. We never thought about this, you know, type of thing. Or, you know, like I drive by a place on the way to work, you know, that could be a risk too, right? But I think just talking to people and trying to figure out the links, I think the epi analysis that they did with the Michigan situation is probably some of the helpful information out there. And I'm sure there's more coming out of it as well too. And I believe multiple states are working with infected flocks and herds to kind of figure out like how they could have tied these events together. But a lot of it is probably circumstantial as well too. So I would say for the commercial industry, I would say keep up the great work. We're on our side in the scientific field. We'll try our best to find, you know, like evidence-based medicine to support what you're doing, and hang tight. And for our fellow poultry producers, like I think we're let's kind of lead or help lead the dairy industry through, because it's very similar to what we dealt with in 2015, where we were lost and in the dark. So I think they're in the same situation we were. So I think kind of being at least a little bit of a mentor, I suppose, in this outbreak mitigation and, you know, prevention control strategies. I think there's a lot they can learn from our end. So continuing to talk within the industries to each other to kind of help get new ideas as well too. And I'm not just precluding it to dairy, like even the swine industry and other industries that dealt with similar contagious disease events. You know, just something, you know, new, novel, creative ideas to kind of figure out a way to kind of stop the spread, or at least work together.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. It's every day is a new adventure.
It sure is.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boehringer Ingelheim. Health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Probiotech International. Creating the next generation of feed and water additives to improve animal nutrition, health, and well-being. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN
for more information. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Making life easier for animals and those who care for them is the mission of Jeffo. Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
Are there any major points or other ideas that we did not cover that you want to make sure you highlight before we end our chat today?
There's a couple of things coming down the pike or have come down the pike. One is AAAP, which is the American Association of Avian Pathologists, just released a position statement on H5N1 that was released on the 23rd of July, so just a couple of days ago. It's on their website. I'm sure there's information out there distributed from different commodity groups, but it's kind of highlighting some of the, you know, the issues that are there and kind of the questions that are still pending. The other thing is there's ongoing studies with like the Southeast Poultry Research Lab at ARS and here at MVSL. There's ongoing studies based on this, you know, virus. So I think in the coming months, we'll get a lot more information, at least understanding, you know, the host immune response interactions or kind of like maybe a little bit about pathogenesis and a little bit more about, I would say a little bit more about how does this virus differ as far as like, you know, like the ecology of the virus, et cetera. So maybe stay tuned for more information coming out. And my biggest question now is what's going to happen with fall migration, right? Like summer is ending very quickly. So I would start considering September as like sort of the fall season. I don't know what the wild birds are doing and I don't even wish to predict what they're doing, but you know, I don't know how it's going to go with the dynamics of the situation once this comes. So, yeah.
Biosecurity forever is what I'm hearing.
Ugh, so scary.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today on updates. They're really timely and relevant. And I know a lot of people are looking for information like this. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'll see you soon.
Yeah. For those of you listening, give us a like and a follow if you are, if you like this episode. Thumbs up. Bye.
Bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.